And when you do niche down, you start to identify your client's pain points. You get to understand, you know, how you can really help them. You start to build relationship currency. So Einstein talks about the eighth wonder of the world is compounding, right? Well, there's relationship equity compounds. Like you get to know more personal injury attorneys who can help individuals. And all of those combine into just a big reason why niching is so incredibly important.
Welcome to the High Performance Legal Entrepreneur Series. My name is Adam Arkfeld, an entrepreneur, marketer, and seeker of high-performing habits, tips, and strategies. Each week, I'll bring to you an elite performer, a legal expert, or simply a strategy to help you see and follow the path to personal greatness in your firm and life. Thank you for joining us today. Now let's get started. Welcome, everyone, to the High Performance Legal Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Arkfeld, president and founder of Prevail Legal Marketing. And today I have Chris Dreyer joining me. He's the CEO of Rankings.io. And Rankings.io helps elite personal injury firms dominate first page rankings. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Awesome. Tell us a little bit about dominating first page rankings. That is an aggressive position to take, and I want to hear more about it.
Geez, where do I start? My dad always just beat into my head, you only play the game to win. It's very Ricky Bobby-ish, you know, the second place, the first loser type of situation. And everything I've done in life, whether it was affiliate marketing or sports or poker, or I did a collectible card game, it was just immersing myself and trying to learn everything possible to really be the best. And just highly competitive. And that's passed on from my father.
How did that lesson get passed on from your father? I mean, you know, I've had conversations like this with other people, and I don't have that. I don't have that be the best mentality, which I think feels negative as a business owner. But how did he pass that along to you?
Jeez, it started in sports and games, like even things like Yahtzee. Okay, like you roll these dice and you go after this because that's what the math probability, like, no, you're doing it wrong type of thing. And, or you play this hand. So it was, you know, games at home were not like fun, you know, open up a cocktail or, you know, we're all laughing. Like it was, there's a winner and a loser. There was a lot of tension. Sports, certainly sports. I don't know where he got his competitiveness, but it was definitely passed to me. And I kind of just took that into everything and almost obsessively focused on things. And sports, it was basketball. So we practice all the time and weekends, Saturdays and Sundays. I had a key to the gym from the superintendent. And I remember my friends would want to come practice with me. But after a practice with my dad, because they thought, oh, we'll go to the gym and play ball. No, it's practice. You don't understand. And they would go to one and they would never want to go again. Because it wasn't fun, right? We were like getting after it. And that's just how it was. And just looking at like, how can I constantly improve? Whether it was poker, we would review, I reviewed 20,000 hands in a month, not the winners, the losers. In collectible card game, you know, I memorized 3,000 cards, every line on the card. So I'd have a competitive advantage versus my opponents because I knew what they were holding. And I did the same for SEO and affiliate marketing. Basically just try to consume every single piece of strategy out there to really take it to the next level.
Well, it certainly shines through in your brand and the results that you've seen and your clientele. So, you know, kudos to you and your dad. Yeah.
Thank you.
So Rankings.io started in around 2013. Is that right?
Yeah, 2013. So what is that? 8 years plus. And at the beginning, we were air quotes, full service law firm marketing agency. Yep. And quickly just kept going to an area of passion, an area of focus, which was SEO. And then fast forward in the future, it was just, hey, what's the most competitive area of legal? Oh, it's personal injury. That's where I want to play. That's what I want to do. And that's part of how we started working with personal injury law firms.
I want to touch on that in a minute, but I do want to hear about starting as full service and then going to niche and why you did that. And I think, you know, because our audience is attorneys, A, what's the impact on an attorney when a firm, when a marketing agency does that? And then B, do you recommend that for attorneys?
Absolutely.
As a specialization.
Niching. Everyone thinks of niching as a niching down, as a scarcity mindset, where they think of immediately you think of less market cap. I have less people to sell to. But the reality is when you're going after everything, you're not a specialist. You know, Malcolm Gladwell says you have to put 10,000 hours into a craft to become an expert. You're not a specialist when you go after everything, and you're automatically losing conversions by trying to go after everything. There's also perception of expertise. When we say, you know, go to the doctor or go to the brain surgeon, you immediately think the brain surgeon is the expert on the brain. And also there's a perception of them being more expensive, right? So in terms of fees and things like that. And there's just so much to niching. It's the world is so competitive, especially in digital, where any kid with a laptop can fire up a website and call themselves a digital agency owner, you know, go file an LLC, throw up a website. And they're not constrained by geography. They're not fractured in that manner. So it's really important for you to be high quality, to be able to stand out in the landscape, to compete in a blue ocean versus the red sea of where everyone's at. And when you do niche down, you start to identify your client's pain points. You get to understand, you know, how you can really help them. You start to build relationship currency. So Einstein talks about the eighth wonder of the world is compounding, right? Well, there's relationship equity compounds. Like you get to know more personal injury attorneys who can help individuals. And all of those combine into just a big reason why niching is so incredibly important.
And how do you think those lessons translate into a law firm? Do you think they get the same value out of it?
I absolutely do. And you'll see some of the biggest, there's different types of niching. And what I'll tell you is, like, look what Law Tigers is doing, right? They're I guess they're not a franchise. They're a licensing. I'm not sure how they get around the the language there, but you know, they own the motorcycle space and they really know how to speak to that consumer. They know how to market to him. And you look at some of the firms that specialize in, say, sexual harassment or sex abuse and how much those cases are worth, or mass torts. So it can be very lucrative. You see these individuals will also get referrals. So I think, you know, Brian Chase for product recall, or trucking accidents, I think, at Joe Freed, their name rings out and resonates. And here's the thing, they can get more value. Joe Freed can get significantly more value from a truck accident case than someone that hasn't tried very many truck accidents. So they are worth it.
Yeah. So not only is it the perception of value, but it's the real value. Like they're just going to perform better. Yeah. I agree with you 100%.
There's operational efficiencies. So you're just doing trucking cases. You know how to research and build a case for a truck. We're just working with personal injury and we just do SEO. We don't have to create an editorial content calendar for criminal defense, for bankruptcy. We don't have to do keyword research. That time that you would have to invest into a different digital agency to discover that information is already saved by working with us.
Yeah. And what I've noticed, because we do the same in pay-per-click, is when I niche or when we focus, it's almost like we have less to do. Yeah, I mean, we do, because we're not trying to learn all these new things and solve all these new problems all the time. And it almost feels less entrepreneurial, like almost more, I don't want to say boring because it just puts us a negative light on it. But as an entrepreneur, I think I want to keep doing new things and trying all these new things. But then when you really niche down, you just stay focused and you don't try other things all the time. Then you're really working on building processes. You're working. And then the things that you actually find boring, you can truly build a process for them and bring in team members to take those off and do it well, instead of just kind of hodgepodge, bringing people, throwing random things against the wall. And it feels less chaotic as a business owner when you're niched down, or at least that's been my experience.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it makes me think of Alex Hormozi. He just had a book, it's $100 million offers. And he talks about the stages of development, you know, 0 to 1 million. You can pick one service and market it one channel. 1 million to 10. Now, obviously, these numbers differ per industry. You're going to need one product to multi channels, or multiple products to one channel, or you need multi products to multi channels. But then when you get from, you know, let's say 10 to 30 million, you need to build infrastructure. You need to have a team of executives and processes and systems. And after that, it's really a difference between an intrapreneur and an entrepreneur, looking for those entrepreneurs that can, you know, take you to the next level through innovation. I think so many businesses struggle because they try to sell multiple services in stage one from zero to a million, when you really just need to focus on being the best at something and then delivering it in the most effective manner.
Yeah. And I even think a million to me actually sounds like a bit of a low number for one service. I think you can do well above a million with one service. And so why bring on other services if you can do one for a high revenue? Yeah. And you mentioned that when you started niching down, you said, let's go for the most competitive space. Now, we've already talked about your competitiveness a bit, but why would you do that? What compelled you to say, this is the hardest thing that I could do, and I'm going to go after it?
Yeah. So with competition, with saturation, is a demand for expertise. If we were working with trademark law firms, and there's one in the city, you know, they're going to sneeze and rank, right? But if there's tons of PI firms, they need a real expert to get to the first page. In a monetary type of way, that's what they're paying for, is that expertise. So if someone gave you $1 million and they said, market to personal injury law firms, or you can market to all law firms, what do you think would be more effective? It'd probably be to go to just PI, because there's more competition there and more need for your services. So many individuals think about niching, and it drives me insane because everyone's got it wrong. They'll say, yeah, I'm niching into home services. Oh, really? No, do you work with plumbers? They self-identify. Oh, you work in legal? That's not niching. Niching is when you work with someone that self-identifies, criminal defense, bankruptcy. Because when you go to an attorney, they don't say, I'm an attorney. They say, I'm a bankruptcy attorney, criminal defense attorney, employment attorney. But people are afraid of that market cap. They're afraid they're going to shrink their pool too much.
Yeah, you're completely right. And I've even thought about that for ourselves, because we have not gone that deep, and it has crossed my mind a number of times, and I have hesitation. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, at the time, was it like a well-configured plan where you were thinking, you know, there's a gap in the market, there's no one doing this premium, or was it just sort of like, let's roll? And I'm curious about that personally, because, you know, early on, it's like, I've done so many things, just like literally make a decision on like a Thursday, and then on Friday, we're changing the course of the business. Did you really think about it? Or was it sort of like, it's most competitive, let's do this?
Oh, there's a ton of thought that goes behind it. And the reality is, you can be successful in many different ways. You can be successful offering a lot of services and marketing those, or working with many different industries. So like, but what's the best for you? And you sound kind of like a DI type personality. You know, we get these shiny objects and we want to go do them. So yeah, when I'm explaining this, I'm explaining this through a lot of pain that I've went through. These things that I've discovered, it's because I've done it wrong. I've had anti-mentor situations. I joined Vistage, which is a peer group for business owners. And I remember my business review, I was doing really well doing law firm SEO. And they went around to the table and they said, you know what you should do? You should go after physicians, home services, and these other areas. And I'm like, you know what? We should do that. And the moment, so I went out, changed my website. Sure, I got a few physician clients and one big home services client, but then something happened. I lost my identity. I lost that flywheel of relationships that kept building up, and it was just it stunted our growth. And when I went back to just legal SEO, it was, here we are again. The momentum picked back up. So a lot of these things are from pain that I've experienced myself.
Yeah. Now, switching gears a little bit, you know, you and I haven't talked about this much, but I just get a sense that your brand sort of means a lot to you, or maybe you think a lot about brand. Is that true? I mean, tell me how much sort of energy you put into your brand itself.
Significantly more now. The first 5-6 years of my business, we really didn't have to even think about marketing. It was really focused. I was a technician, Michael Gerber. You start as a technician, you open a business. I was an SEO guy, and it was do great work and get referrals. And we grew to, let's say, 3 million doing that, doing good work, getting referrals. But at some point, referrals can be feast or famine. Also, your referral partners can become threatened by your growth. You may not get the same amount of referrals that you did in the past when you're the little guy. And it became inevitable that I had to create a brand. And I don't, from the outward, I don't really think that we still have a brand. I think we do are starting to develop one. We are investing 15% of our top line minimum every month in our marketing, which just grows every, you know, it's a good chunk. But it's a necessity in order to generate your own leads.
Yeah. And so you mentioned Vistage, you mentioned some of the just trials and tribulations that you've experienced over the last 8 years. What do you think some of the most important decisions or steps helped you grow your brand and business? I mean, are there any pivotal moments that you think really made a huge difference?
Niching down to just SEO when we were doing PPC and design was huge. The PPC side, we were making a decent amount of money. It's just, I didn't have a team around me that could execute it on the highest level. And for design, I always considered, and I think most digital agency owners consider design as like a loss leader. So you sell them a website, then you can sell them marketing services. But for us, it was actually completely backwards. The only people that were buying websites from us was our existing clients that already had SEO. So our profit margins were really low. Now, there are things I know now that I didn't back then that I could have done to make them more profitable. But that was a big pivotal moment, was going to just SEO. There's been critical hires, right? It's building a phenomenal team. It's understanding the importance of having excellent talent and not settling for mediocre performers. For me, the hardest thing to do is to terminate someone, because it's maybe it was my fault or my leadership's fault on not identifying something or not giving them the support or training that they needed. And we become a lot better in selecting talent, weeding out individuals that won't thrive in our culture. So that's a big one, is the talent. And then the third one I would say biggest would be the niching down even to a subset below legals down to PI.
Yeah. And, you know, for anyone that's listening that doesn't, well, I don't know. So when you are running SEO for PR firms, how do you handle the competition in different markets? I'd be curious about, because, you know, do you run clients against each other in the same market, or how does that work?
That's a really good question. It's one that we've really struggled with too, to be honest, is personal injury attorneys in particular are very conditioned to ask for exclusivity and want it because of doing TV and radio, where TV and radio, they sell DMAs, but they already own the impressions or selling off the impressions, versus SEO, where you have to acquire this real estate. And the other thing that we've had trouble with is in Google Maps, particularly, proximity matters. So if you're downtown Houston and you have a client there, and there's a client that opens an office, you know, 15 miles north, they don't really compete in the map pack. So for us, we don't have like a on the website policy for exclusivity, because we like to make that decision. Are they a true competitor or not? Are they even targeting the same practice area? And we also don't like to restrict our client's ability to grow. So if we have one client in Georgia and they want to open an office in Chicago, like who am I to tell, you know, in Illinois, Chicago, Who am I to tell them no? And so that's the way I look at it. I think that knowing my avatar too, they don't want us to work with two in a market. They don't, I know some of our big competitors will take three or four, or they'll be a mile radius, or they'll be, hey, you get the whole city or county, but we have a more internal policy that can we generate this client an ROI and this client? If so, cool, let's go. But if we can't, it's an integrity thing and just the nature of being competitive that I don't want to be number two. If I can't generate them a revenue, then it doesn't make sense. So that's how we approach it. I know it's kind of a, we don't have like an exact, you know, formula for this because it's different and the mile radius is different. Look at New York versus Texas, you know, these large cities in Texas. So that's what we try to do.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you mentioned there's a lot of nuance to a question like that. And, you know, with pay-per-click, we get asked the question as well. And one of the ways that one of my perspectives on it is that if someone's going to enter a market or they're going to increase their spend, let's say I'm bidding $20 on a keyword and someone else comes in, they say, I want you to run my ads. And I say, well, I can't because I have exclusivity. They might hire an ad manager that's less experienced than we are. That's going to bid 25 or 30 per keyword. And so the only thing that does is it increases the cost of my original client up to $25 per click. Whereas if you have a good ad manager running it, and maybe they hire a good ad manager, they're probably going to be running bids closer to 22, 20, you know, kind of where we were. And so it actually inflates the entire market when there are people running ads that are bidding too high and maybe where ROI is not being tracked closely and things like that. And that's part of the problem with the pay-per-click industry in general is people running really high bidding campaigns and not really getting the ROI, but bidding out everyone else in the market. And so there's just a lot of nuances to these types of conversations with exclusivity. And the map pack is a really good example on the SEO side. I never thought of that.
Yeah. And on the pay-per-click side, their legal is so fractured. So everything else is they're doing this consolidation for economies to scale. And it's interesting where legal's been a little bit slow to adapt. But, you know, in that situation, it's like, okay, let's, instead of the budget being 20,000, let's jump it up to 40, right? And share the pool. You know, I know individuals like Walk Up Advertising over in California, they pool their budgets for economies of scale. That's how they get low cost per acquisition. But it's a difficult conversation to have. And I think consolidation is inevitable at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very counterintuitive and kind of attacks the ego a little bit, but the math mm-hmm. is the math. So you're mentioning some of those business decisions for the business itself and growth. What about like personally? You mentioned Vistage. I think I saw, I did see on one of your LinkedIn videos talking about being in different coaching programs. What's been your investment in those and how have they helped you?
We invest a ton in our leadership. Our salespeople are in Southwestern Consulting. We have an operational coach. We've got external SEO coaches. We have a CFO coach for finance. For me personally, Carl Sakis is my digital agency coach. He's amazing. I've been working with him for 3 years. And I'm in a couple of masterminds, Jason Swinks. I'm in Joey Gilkey's. And it's just critical to surround yourself with people that are better than you, or the people can help you get to the next level. And it's hard to put egos aside maybe, but I know that I'm not the best at everything. And there are individuals that really excel in areas that I'm deficient. And it's good to have people that can help. So we really invest a ton in education.
Yeah. And so you do it with your team as well. I typically hear CEOs talking about all the programs that they're in personally, but you bring in a lot of vendors for your team.
Yeah, my president's in CEO Alliance. He's in the key group for Vistage. Brett Harn, coach, our director of ops. We had Southwestern Consulting for our AMs and for our sales reps. CFO coach, like we put our director of marketing in all the biggest marketing conferences for new ideas. You have to, because those individuals help elevate those below them. And you need to have this multiplying effect, an effect that can really develop your team. And what I look at is, sure, coaching may be X amount. I won't disclose exactly how much I'm paying. It's pricey, but I look at it, do I get that amount of value from it per year? Absolutely. And that's what we're trying to do, just continue to improve and pass on that education, because that education can help build in efficiencies and better margins.
Yeah. With your legal clients, what do some of your top performing law firms and clients just do differently than the others? You know, you have clients that are really killing it, kicking ass, and then you have others that are maybe just doing moderately well. Maybe that's all on you. Maybe it's not. I mean, I don't mean doing moderately well, but I mean, maybe their success is more on you than it is on them because of your service. But tell me a little bit about the firms that are really doing well and what their mindset looks like and they're doing differently than others that aren't doing as well.
That's a really good question. I would say kind of twofold. They've surrounded themselves with a good team. They're really investing in their people. They have a lot of staff, people in the right positions. The other thing that they're doing is they're investing heavily in their marketing, and not just one specific channel. They are building a brand, because when you build a brand, they all kind of work off of each other, and you can get the overall lower cost per case. You know, as well as I do, if someone's doing TV $10 million a year, and you come in to do pay-per-click or SEO, you're probably going to do a little bit better than the person that doesn't have a brand at all. But it's, I hate to kind of give a boring answer and to repeat, but it's having the right people, developing a team, investing in their marketing. That's what we see.
Yeah. And you were talking about finding the right team for your company earlier. How do you determine if someone's a good culture fit? You know, if they're the right seat, right person in the right seat. You know, I mean, technical is a lot easier. You know, you can assess technical pretty quickly. How do you assess culture? And then how long do they have at your company before you decide if they're going to stay?
We're an EOS traction-based agency. So they have some basic tools for this. They have a, once you identify your core values, you'll do this people analyzer exercise to give an individual a plus minus. You know, for ours, they are commitment to quality. It is their team player, and we have send and delete. We only have three. So send and delete, we send, you know, stuff gets executed on if we send it to you. Team player, we're not looking for Pollyannas that are just relentlessly happy at all times, but we're also not looking for Eeyores, you know, that are kind of just a drain. And commitment to quality, we're looking for people that aren't just going to settle for fine. So we can analyze our individuals as they come into the pipe for hiring or existing team on those values. The other thing that we do is another exercise they call GWC, get at one at capacity. In other words, the what, the motivation, and the how. Do they know what to do? Are they motivated to do it? And then do they know how to do it? So that's a good one, because most times people just think of the get at one at capacity, but it's really what, how, and do they want to do it? And you can analyze people on that, but there are a lot of things that we do. We do personality assessments. We're big believers in that. And we use DISC, and it's just a rigorous hiring process. And you really want to just be careful to protect your culture.
On the, I just had it in my mind, but I forgot it. The get it, want to do it, how? What were the three?
The capacity to do it. Do they get it? Do they want it? And do they have the capacity? Do they know what to do? Do they want to do it? Are they motivated? And do they know how to do it? Training, culture, that's everything.
Yeah, I haven't broken it down into those three steps, but I have found myself having that conversation with my managers when something goes wrong with someone and they'll say, hey, this person's like not doing this thing. And then that distinction of, do they not want to do it? Are they not motivated? Or do they just not know how to do it? It's just that question in itself, I think, is so powerful when assessing the performance of a candidate or of an employee, because that's a huge difference. You know, Are they not motivated or are they not aware? Just massive difference.
Yeah. And how do you fix that? It's culture and training.
Yeah.
That's why training is critical.
Yeah. Do you mind me asking on the DISC profile, on the DISC assessments, what are the typical profiles of people that you hire as, you know, in your account management team as your practitioners?
It's a really good question. I'm a DI driver. Our account managers are typically ID or S.
ID or S? Yep. Mm-hmm. Cool.
That's a little secret sauce there.
Well, we use the DISC as well. And the one we do, it actually gives a title to the profile. And I don't think they're all like this. I don't know if they are. So I know like those titles more than I know the letters. So like we hire objective thinkers. If we ever get someone that's a promoter, it typically means that they prefer to promote themselves and look good, either wanting more money or sort of like glossing over mistakes and like hiding mistakes. And I can't remember the exact letters for it, but I can look at those profiles and they're powerful. And we hire on those almost exclusively. It's not exclusively, but it's a really important factor.
And for those Slack users that have Slack, we put our name, Chris Dreyer, and then parentheses DI. Or Stephen Willey, parentheses S. And because it helps for you to understand how this individual likes to be communicated, how they absorb information. And I think there's a good website called Crystal Knows that helps define those individual letters and how they can, you know, relate to the job.
Yeah. Yeah. And one that I've come across lately is the Enneagram. I don't know if you've spent any time on that personality test. I actually really am really impressed with the Enneagram personality profiles too. Nice. They break them down into more like caricatures almost.
Oh, and, cool.
I'm a number two, strict perfectionist. So
there you go.
I do like that one. All right. And so with your clients, you know, I was sort of, I was looking on your website and I was kind of looking at some of the quotes and they were like, you know, this person's on the first page for this keyword or whatever. And so I'm like, I just want to see if that's like still true. You know, I know when you put those, so I Googled and they were up there. I can't remember exactly who it was for the keyword that you advertised. And I was like, all right, there you go. But then it led me to the question of how in God's name do you keep them up there? How do they stay in those positions for like, how do your clients stay competitive? Because like you said, it's the most competitive SEO space out there, probably amongst any industry. I mean, definitely legal industry. Mm-hmm. How do you keep them up there?
Yeah. So the answer there is you have to create a moat or a barrier to entry. You have to create a gap. And the answer is, what are the things my competitors aren't willing to do? Getting directory links, easy. Go sign up, fill your information out, done. Creating an exceptional piece of content that you then have the ability to do digital PR, very hard. So the answer is do the things that are difficult to do that you can create a gap. If I look at my competitors and they've got all, you know, similar link profile, well, has my client written a book? I can go get links from publishers. Are they in a podcast? I can get links from podcasts. Have they, do they have a PDF that they put together on something to where I can submit to PDF directories or audio-based sites or video directories? The answer is to create the things that are difficult to replicate. And that's where the true gap comes. Maybe it's a feature in Wall Street Journal or a quote, you know, with Help a Reporter Out. It is also when you think of content, Brian Dean. Love Brian Dean, Backlinko, Skyscraper Technique. Go look at your competitors, do what they, you know, something better than them. Well, yes and no. If it's, you can do that, or you can create an entirely different concept. So by the nature of being different, you automatically stand out. If everyone's writing an ultimate guide, everyone's writing a list post, you create something different, and it maybe instead of it being first person, it's third person, or you have multiple author contributions, like a roundup, all those things combined, it's do the things that are difficult and create a barrier to entry.
And so does your firm, your agency, actually do that work? You know, you said writing a book, clearly, you know, you can have people write books, you know, hire them out or whatever. Or when it comes to those things, is it primarily strategy?
So I lost you there just for a little bit.
With the, when you're talking about those different ideas, is the execution done by your agency internally, or are you primarily strategizing with other people about what to do? And then they go do the book or they do the podcast, or just what role do you play in that?
That's really good. Most of the time we help facilitate it, whether we're doing it or we bring on a strategic partner. It's a book. Maybe we're introducing them to Scribe Media, Tucker Max's company. If it is a, let's think about a podcast. Maybe we're introducing them to a Lower Street or a Rise 25. But a lot of times the clientele that we work with that are, you know, these eight-figure, nine-figure type firms, they already have a lot of those resources. And you have to think about how can we use this as leverage that isn't already being taken, you know, that they aren't currently utilizing. They'll have a book, but they don't submit it to all the publishers, to all the sites that have that where you can list this book, or they have a podcast, but maybe they're not in all the podcast directories, or they're willing to be on a podcast as a guest, but they aren't actively going out and doing that. So we'll introduce them to a podcast bookers, you know, John Jantz's company, Duct Tape Marketing, or we'll do it ourselves. So a lot of it us, but we also bring in strategic partners when we need to.
Yeah, got it. Okay,
can I go down a tangent there just for 1 second?
You can go down any tangent you want.
All right. So when we use the word strategic partners, and a lot of people look negatively at us and they say, oh, they outsource stuff. But let me pose this question back to the audience. You yourself, you know how to make eggs or a hamburger, but you still go to restaurants, right? Okay. And just because you had a bad meal at a restaurant doesn't mean you stop going there. Maybe you order a different sandwich, or maybe you go to a different restaurant entirely. So that's kind of my point, that you have these niche experts in other areas, podcast booking, podcast production, and ghostwriting books. Like, don't be afraid to do that and try to own that you don't outsource anything. That's just a false way of looking at how the world works, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I mean, completely. And the sheer fact that they're working with you means that they're outsourcing to an expert, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. What's your take on the contrary perspective I hear on specialists versus, you know, doing things internally or a full service agency, is managing multiple vendors versus, so it's like, the clients know that if they hire a full service agency, the quality is probably not going to be as good. Like, I feel like a lot of them actually know this, but a lot of times they'll hire a full service agency because they only want one point of contact versus having to manage multiple vendors.
Mm-hmm. So it's that agency of record versus experts. That's just not how today, there's just too much competition for that to work like that. I mean, you look at the medical profession, you're not going to one doctor to know everything about the body. You're going to the brain surgeon, the urologist, the whatever. You have to have these because there's such an amount of vast knowledge the deeper you go in a certain area. And you have to go that deep to really become that expert. The other thing is, when you think of just leverage, let's talk about leverage, for example. There is full-time employees. They are the highest maintenance, with the highest amount of control. Highest maintenance meaning you got to keep them happy. You got to make sure they know how to do their work. Highest control that you can get them to do whatever you want. Then you got freelancers. Medium control, medium maintenance. Also, freelancers could be called subcontractors. Medium control they may just get hired by somebody else or their utilization sucked up, but they at least know how to do the craft. You're not going to a freelancer and saying, trying to train the freelancer. And then you've got outsourcing, working with an agency, outsourcing, whatever you want to call it. It's the lowest maintenance because they already know how to do the work. You're paying them to get the good, but it's the lowest amount of control. They already have their processes. You're not going to tell the cook in the back of the restaurant how to cook your burger, other than maybe that was a bad example. You're going to tell them how to make their sushi. right? But that's how you know, things operate, and you need to look at those examples as well.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, if you're hiring, if you have an agency of record, you're hiring a full service, you know, like my agency, we started off doing website development, then we went like full service. And then very quickly I realized this is a bad idea. And then we grew the website and we ended up doing a hard reset on pay-per-click a number of years ago. But, you know, if you're hiring a full service agency, they're competing with you, you know, with rankings.io. And if I were a full service agency and my law firm client said, hey, we want to be number one, and you're competing with these guys, I'd be like, oh man, that does not seem like a good, I'm not going to enjoy that competition. I'm pretty sure I'm going to lose. So, you know, the specialist is a specialist, and there's a ton of value in that.
Yeah. And those full service agencies, they're typically structured, you know, manager specialists, where it's a jack of all trades, where they have to do a lot of skills versus, you know, our span of control. We have a content department, an on-site department, a local department, a link building department, account management strategy, and it's all SEO. So the span of control is wider, but there's deeper expertise.
Yeah. All right. Last question before we ramp up. So I saw on your LinkedIn that you were a detention room teacher and JV basketball coach.
I was.
I want to hear how you became a detention room teacher and if you learned anything about that, because I've never seen that on anyone's profile before.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. But that is my story. I went to college. I told my parents that I was going to college just to get a degree and I was going to own my own business. That was what I told them. But I'll go to college. You want me to do that and have security. So I ended up with a history education degree after partying and not being the best student because I wasn't passionate about history. And I liked basketball from my high school days. And I got hired at a high school to be their JV basketball coach. And they didn't have a teaching position, but they had this detention room position. It was on the same track as teachers. So if I was an alternative classroom teacher for 3 years and a teacher a fourth, well, on my experience, it'd be a four-year teacher. So it was like a stepping stone, a decent pay from a teaching perspective. And that's actually where I got my start because I was in a detention room, bored out of my mind, and typed in how to make money online. And that's how I found affiliate marketing and digital marketing.
Oh, that's cool. I did not. That's really cool. That's where that started.
Yep.
All right. Well, now it's not hard to find a teaching position. I mean, back in the day, it must have been
hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's easy. All right. Great. Well, you know, we've already said a couple of times, your website is rankings.io. You know, if people want to learn more about you, you have a lot of content on LinkedIn. So I would encourage people to go to LinkedIn, connect with Chris Dreyer, rankings.io, and follow his content because it's amazing. You also have a podcast. So tell us about a couple of things that you're doing where people can hear more about you.
Yeah. So you nailed it. Website, LinkedIn. I'm most active on LinkedIn. If you go to connect with me on like Twitter or Instagram, it's probably not me. It's probably the marketing people. But on LinkedIn, I'm really active there. And I'm the host of the Personal Injury Marketing Mastermind, where we have elite personal injury attorneys and big name marketers on. We had Seth Godin, Neil Patel on. And that's kind of what's going on right now. And Adam, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, Chris, I appreciate it. It's an honor to have you. And to everybody else, thanks a lot. And we'll see you in the next episode.